This is The Vital Connection, a program helping connect Christ and your community. And now, here is your host, Dr. Bill Campbell.
Good morning. We're glad you have joined us for The Vital Connection. And our guest today is Frank Turek. Good morning, Frank.
Hey, good morning, Bill. How you doing?
Great. Thank you for being with us this morning.
Absolutely.
Frank has written a book with a rather telling title, which is I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. Co-author with Dr. Norman Geisler. Frank, I found this book to be very meaty, full of a lot of good information, and I'm looking forward to diving into it with you and with our listeners. But first, why don't you tell us a little bit about how you came into the ministry cross-examined, how it is that you began defending the faith. And listeners, you should know Frank has got his own cable television show. He's got a radio program. He's written some excellent books. He's making a big impact, especially in the student world. Frank, give us some background.
Well, one of the reasons we started crossexamined.org back in about 2006, Bill, was because about 75% of young people walk away from the church once they leave the home. So 3 out of 4 kids in an average youth group today won't be going to church after they go to college, and about half of them stay away the rest of their lives. Half of the ones that leave, about a half ultimately come back by the time they're about age 30. But the main point here is that 3 out of 4 leave, and one of the major reasons they leave is because intellectually they don't know why Christianity is true, and part of the reason for that is we've never told them why it's true, and that's why we started crossexamined.org, crossexamined with a D on the end of it. What we do is we go to college campuses, we go to high school campuses, and we go to churches, and we present I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. We also, as you mentioned, do TV on DirecTV, channel 378, every Wednesday night at 9 p.m. And we also do radio every Saturday morning at 10 a.m. on a number of stations around the country. All the details are on our website, crossexamined.org.
Fantastic. Did you, at a point in your life, Frank, have doubts about the existence of God or about the Christian faith?
Well, I never really doubted whether God existed. I knew there always had to be a first cause. I mean, that just kind of seems self-evident to me. I think that there is some sort of immaterial force beyond us that began the whole thing. But I didn't know much about Jesus. I grew up in the Catholic Church I grew up in New Jersey, and it's federal law that you have to be a Catholic if you're from New Jersey. Well, not really, but you get the idea. Right. It's a very Catholic area, so I went to Catholic high school and all this. But I never really knew who Jesus was until I got into the Navy and ran into a son of a Methodist minister, and we began going to a Baptist church, and I actually learned quite a bit in the sermons, which, you know, sermons in Catholic churches are very short, but I learned quite a bit in a Baptist service. And then I came to faith predominantly through reading Josh McDowell books, like Evidence of a Man's Verdict and More Than a Carpenter, and so I was always interested in apologetics. I was always interested in evidence, and that's how I got into it once I got out of the Navy.
And how did you hook up with Dr. Norman Geisler?
I was taking a class in apologetics at McLean Bible Church right outside of Washington, D.C., and the teacher there was a man by the name of Barry Leventhal, who's a Messianic Jewish gentleman, and he had a professor at Dallas Theological Seminary when he went there by the name of Norman Geisler, who at the time was sort of the Michael Jordan of apologetics. I guess you could say he kind of still is. He's written like 100 books, you know. I mean, books fall out of his head every night. But in any event, he came in for the weekend seminar portion of this class, and he wound up staying at our house, and he had just started a seminary down here in Charlotte, North Carolina, and he was interested in having, you know, recruiting students, and I was interested in apologetics, and he invited us to come down and look at the seminary back in, this is 20 years ago now, this is 1993.
Mm-hmm.
And I always thought, look, if I was interested in getting involved in basketball, and Michael Jordan came to my house and said, I got a camp down in North Carolina, I'll teach you how to play, would I go? Well, yeah. Well, so he invited us down to check out the seminary back in 1993, and we wound up moving down here shortly thereafter and going to seminary, and that's how I got really involved in apologetics in a vocational way.
Wow. I won't go into this, but Barry Leventhal's a friend, and I have a lot of connections up there in D.C. also, including the McLean Bible. That's pretty incredible.
Yeah, now Barry, by the way, is a professor at Southern Evangelical Seminary.
Yeah.
Barry Leventhal, who is, as I say, a Messianic Jewish gentleman. In fact, he's the primary subject of Chapter 13 of I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, because one of the arguments we use for Christianity is the Old Testament prophecy, particularly Isaiah chapter 53.
Mm.
And Barry pretty much came to faith through Isaiah chapter 53, and his whole story is in chapter 13 about not having enough faith to be an atheist.
Wow. Well, let's dive in a little bit, starting at the beginning. We have this whole notion in our, what is often termed a postmodern society, that there is no such thing as absolute truth.
Mm-hmm.
What would you say to that, Frank?
Is that true?
Okay.
I mean, it's self-defeating to say there is no truth. It's like saying I can't speak a word in English. You know, it's
right.
It, postmodernism, relativism, they're all self-defeating because they're saying there is no truth while they're uttering the truth claim there is no truth. You know, it's like saying all truth is relative. Well, that's an absolute truth right there. It defeats itself. It can't be true. It's like saying my parents had no kids that lived. You know, I mean, it just doesn't work.
And while we would admit it doesn't work, we fall into the trap constantly, don't we? Especially when we deal with science today. What are some of the presuppositions, the a priori presuppositions that go into the making of so many scientific theories today?
Well, science is just a method by which we discover causes. It's a search for causes. And the science... Modern science quite frequently has an assumption behind it, and that assumption is that the only types of causes are natural causes, that there are no intelligent causes, and there certainly aren't any supernatural causes. And so science presupposes that God doesn't exist, at least I shouldn't say science presupposes it, but scientists presuppose it, because in actuality, Bill, science doesn't say anything, scientists do.
Uh-huh.
All data needs to be interpreted.
Right.
In fact, let's just take a look at the origin of life, for example. You get a what's considered simple life, but it's not really simple. An amoeba has about 1,000 volumes worth of Encyclopedia Britannica of information in it, in its DNA. I mean, 1,000 volumes of an encyclopedia worth of DNA. Now, to say that that resulted by natural forces without any intelligence is like saying that the Library of Congress resulted from an explosion in a printing shop.
Yeah.
You know, I don't have enough faith to believe that. Yet, many scientists try and say there had to be a natural cause for it. Why? Because philosophically they've ruled out intelligent or supernatural causes, and so they say it has to be a natural cause. Well, that's a result of their philosophical presupposition. It's not a result of the evidence. You see, all data needs to be interpreted. When you look at a one-celled amoeba, it doesn't say made by Yahweh on there. Neither does it say came together by natural forces without intelligent intervention.
Mm-hmm.
You have to look at the data and draw a conclusion. And I think that many scientists, when they look at the data, they've already drawn the conclusion by ruling out intelligent causes before they look at the evidence.
Yes, I agree with you. But then we have, let's say, Richard Dawkins, who, in his Blind Watchmaker, goes on to say, well, you religious people are assuming there's a God. You can't prove that. In fact, that's your biggest fallacy. If you say things come because of cause, what caused God?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. Well, first of all, the principle of causality does not say everything had a cause. The
right.
principle of causality says everything that comes to be has a cause. There has to be an uncaused first cause, because you can't go on an infinite regress of causes. There has to be something that isn't caused itself, that is the beginning point. I mean, Aristotle knew this. He knew there had to be an unmoved mover.
Mm-hmm.
So there's only one question, and that is, if something exists, and obviously we exist, so something exists, then something must have always existed. The question is it the universe that's always existed, or is it something outside the universe that has always existed? All the evidence, and we go through this in the book, I don't have enough faith to be an atheist. All the evidence points to the fact that the universe had a beginning, that the universe is not the uncaused first cause.
Right.
If the universe is not the uncaused first cause, then the uncaused first cause has to be something that transcends the universe. In fact, the scientific evidence points to the fact that space, matter, and time had a beginning. More precisely, space, time, and matter. had a beginning out of nothing. This is the standard Big Bang cosmology, that space, time, and matter had a beginning out of nothing. If that's the case, then the cause must transcend space, time, and matter. In other words, it must be spaceless, timeless, and immaterial. Now, if you're timeless, you don't have a beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, you don't have a cause. So whatever created the universe is the uncaused first cause. So Richard Dawkins doesn't really get anywhere by asking who made God, because if God is unmade, he doesn't have a maker.
Mm-hmm.
You don't ask who created the uncreated. Now, you can ask the question, but if God is uncreated, he didn't have a beginning. So the uncaused first cause is what we mean by God.
It's interesting how Asimov and others will say, well, actually, before the Big Bang, there were mathematical principles. There, you know, there are these infinitesimal points of existence of some sort. And what do you say to that when they try to put something there other than a first being?
Well, first of all, the evidence doesn't say there was something there, something physical there. The evidence seems to point to a beginning to the space-time continuum. So there wasn't a quantum vacuum. There weren't swirling mathematical points, whatever that means. There was not positive and negative energy, as Isaac Asimov has said. There was nothing, no thing, non-being. And again, if there was non-being in terms of space, matter, and time, then whatever caused the universe has to be beyond space, matter, and time. So, and one wonders, Bill, I mean, if you think about this, like Peter Atkins from Oxford University in his debate with William Lane Craig tried to say, well, swirling mathematical points existed prior to the Big Bang.
Uh-huh.
Well, even if that were true, what would that mean? And how could a swirling mathematical points create anything? What are swirling mathematical points? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
These people are just grasping at anything to avoid God. That's why here's the question I ask people who are not believers. This is a key question to ask people.
Yeah.
The question is this. If Christianity were true, would you become a Christian? Because if they hesitate at all, it's not really an intellectual objection. It's a volitional objection. They don't want it to be true.
Yes.
And I found that at college campuses. I've asked that question on college campuses several times, and on several occasions I've had people yell back at me, no! No! Wait. You claim to be an atheist, a beacon of reason. Never mind that if atheism's true, reason doesn't exist, because we're just molecules in motion. We're not really reasoning, we're just reacting. But let's leave that aside. If Christianity were true, would you believe it? And you say no. How is that reasonable? It's not reasonable at all.
Yeah, it's volitional, as you say. It's emotional. It's psychological.
You don't want it to be true because you don't want to give up your autonomy, or you don't want to stop doing something that you think you ought to stop doing if Christianity is true, or you want to be the boss of your own life, or some Christian wronged you in the past and you think this is your way of getting back at him, or whatever it is. Now, to be fair, Bill, there are obviously Christians who just want to believe Christianity because they want to, not because they have any evidence for it.
Right, right.
It cuts both ways, but the question is, which belief system has better evidence for it, that there is a God or that there isn't a God? And I think it takes a lot more faith to believe there is no God than to believe there is.
If only more people would do the thinking and do the research, I think we'd be in a much better place.
Well, true. And one thing you can ask people when they say something that you don't agree with, like, for example, some people say, well, I can't believe the Bible, it's been changed throughout the centuries. My question is, well, how'd you come to that conclusion? How has it been changed throughout the centuries? What do you mean by that?
Right.
Because I can guarantee you, most people haven't really investigated the question. They've heard a slogan that they're repeating, but they've never investigated for themselves. In fact, if you wanted to be a little bit more specific, if somebody says, I can't believe the Bible because it's been changed throughout the centuries, you might say to them, well, how do you know that? Have you been investigating the manuscript evidence for yourself? I mean, how many people are going to say to you, yeah, Bill, just the other night I was looking at the Byzantine stream of manuscripts? No. They're not going to do that, because they probably haven't investigated it for themselves. They are simply just hearing or repeating a slogan they've heard.
Yes, and worse than that, these bestseller new atheist books, like Christopher Hitchens, mm-hmm. he deals with Scripture, and I've read some of his stuff, and it's just, it makes me sick to the stomach, because I know what he is either covering up or he just plain doesn't know. And you've debated Christopher Hitchens. Tell me how that went.
Well, people can see see how it went, they can go to our website, crossexamined.org, on the homepage. They can watch both debates for free, so they're up there. I let other people decide who won and all that. Tragically, Christopher died about a year ago, so he's no longer with us.
Yeah.
But he's very witty and fun guy to listen to, but he didn't have arguments, and he really just had complaints. He didn't like things about Christianity.
Right.
It wasn't a rational thing. It was more an emotional resistance to Christianity. In fact, he didn't call himself an atheist. He called himself an anti-theist.
Yeah.
Which is just showing you it's not just intellectual. It's I'm against God. It's not just that I don't believe there's a God. I'm against him.
Well, in fact, there is no true atheist in the world, is there?
Well, I mean, I suppose they could say they don't believe in God. What do you mean by...
But, well, the point being you cannot prove there is no God. You can prove that you don't... You can prove that you can't prove there is a God. I suppose if atheism is simply a belief system, it's a religion like any other, and it's based on faith.
Yeah, if atheists try and say, well, it's just a lack in belief, I would say, well, so you're saying that's just a statement about your psychological state? You're not saying it's a statement about the real world? Well, then, who cares?
Yeah.
I mean, atheists, we know, are claiming there is no God. They're not saying, I just don't believe it.
Right.
They're saying it's positively true that such a being doesn't exist. So it's not just a belief about their psychological state or a statement about their psychological state. They're making an affirmative statement that no such being exists. Now, even Richard Dawkins will admit, well, I can't prove that with 100% certainty.
Right,
well, true.
Right.
But I can't prove with 100% certainty Christianity is true either. But very few things in life you can prove with 100% certainty.
Yeah.
We deal in probability all the time, beyond a reasonable doubt.
And that's the whole point of your book. Let's look reasonably at the evidence, and it points toward Christ and Christianity as being justified, verified. But the atheist himself, herself, is a religious person. It takes faith to be an atheist, doesn't it?
It depends on what you mean by religion and faith. Yeah, if faith means... The biblical definition of faith is... putting trust in something that you have evidence to believe is true. But the colloquial definition of faith in our culture means believing something in spite of the evidence, or even when you don't have evidence, right?
Yeah.
That's what it means. It means like a total leap in the dark. And that's the sense we use it with the book, you know.
Right. Okay.
But the biblical definition of faith is trusting in something that you have evidence to believe is true. See, there's a difference between belief that and belief in. Belief that is getting evidence that something is true, but belief in is once you have the evidence, putting your trust in it. And so there's a difference there.
So you're dealing all the time with these college kids who, as you say, I love this quoting from your book, have been sent by their parents from all over the world, whose parents are paying thousands of dollars for college tuition so the sons and daughters can be taught the truth that there is no truth. And if there's no truth, what's the basis for education?
Yeah, why are you going to college? To learn the opinions of the professor? And is it true that he or she has those opinions? You see, you can't get away from truth. It's there. The question is, what is true?
Right.
By the way, let me just say this, that most college campuses, or I should put it this way, most professors are not postmodern. They're not relativists, unless they teach in the English department or the humanities department. Certainly the physicists, the philosophers, the chemistry professors, the biology professors, they're not relativists. Most of them believe in absolute truth.
Yeah.
You get the relativism in the humanities departments, not the science departments.
Or religion.
Yeah. Yeah, sometimes you get it in the religion department, too.
Yeah.
But it's just a self-defeating position. It's like saying I can't speak a word in English to say there is no truth.
Well, what do you say to the religious pluralist? Often that's the form being taught by many professors in universities today. Who say every religion works, there are many ways to heaven, they're all good.
Well, I would say the evidence doesn't show that. You know, all roads lead to Rome. Well, that's not even true in reality. Can you take any road and get to Rome? Why would you think that was true about religion?
Yeah.
They're mutually contradictory.
Yeah. Yeah, so there are, as you point out, and C.S. Lewis does too in his Mere Christianity, there are three main types of religion. Unpack that for us for a minute.
Well, If you're asking me a question, I think you're asking me, there are three major religious worldviews.
That's right.
There's theism, like Judaism, Christianity, and Islam are theistic, which means God made all. God creates the universe and sustains it right now, but he's not the universe. There's pantheism. God is all. God is me. God is you. God is the grass. God is the trees. God is all things. You know, God is the universe, such as Zen Buddhism, Hinduism, and the New Age. They're all pantheistic, and most of our listeners will know what Zen Buddhism is. Use the Force, Luke. You know, the whole Star Wars series is Zen Buddhism. There's no real personal God. It's an impersonal force that is the universe. And the third religious worldview, the major religious worldview, is atheism. There is no God. The universe just exists, and that's it. We're just molecules in motion. We're materialists.
Yeah, and as we stack these against each other, they can't all be true.
No, if one's true, the other two are false.
Yeah, so this idea of religious pluralism should be challenged with just some common sense thinking.
Now, by the way, let me clarify that, though, Bill.
Okay.
When we're saying that, let's say we say theism's true, and all non-theisms are false, that doesn't mean that everything taught by a non-theistic religion is false.
Right.
It might mean that, maybe they teach something that's true.
Right.
But when it comes to the existence and nature of God, they have it wrong.
That's right. On what basis, Frank, would you say the scales of evidence would tilt toward Christianity?
You mean after you establish that God exists, there's a theistic God?
Yeah, and we may come back to the whole idea of God's existing. And if you're listening now and you wish to call in, we welcome that, 693-WHKP. Yeah, if you're given that there is a God, you look at the DNA, you look, as your book does, at astronomy with a telescope, and the basically almost infinitesimally small chance that all these things could have just come to being without a divine cause. And why would you tilt toward Christianity?
Well, first of all, the book takes a logical progression. It starts with the question of truth. Does truth exist? Then it goes on to the question of God. Does God exist? Then it looks at miracles. Are they possible? And then it gets into the New Testament to see if miracles have occurred in the New Testament times to affirm that Jesus really was who he said he was. And then it goes on ultimately to point out that the whole Bible is true. So you first have to establish, does truth exist, which it's self-defeating to say it doesn't. To say there is no truth is to make a truth claim. So truth does exist. The question is it true that God exists? And what we do is we go through three major arguments that a theistic God, a God who's beyond the world, who created the world and sustains the world, exists. And those three arguments are from the beginning of the universe, the design of the universe, and the design of life, and the moral argument, that there is a moral lawgiver out there.
Mm-hmm.
And when you add those three arguments up, you get a spaceless, timeless, immaterial, powerful, moral, personal, intelligent creator. So you establish theism before you move on to Christianity. So does God exist? Yes, we have these arguments which shows that there's a theistic God. The next question is, are miracles possible? And a lot of people have trouble with miracles in the Bible. You know, can we believe in Jonah? That seems outlandish. Resurrections, they don't occur. Come on, how can we believe in a resurrection or walking on water or any of these things? But I always ask people, I say, what's the greatest miracle in the Bible? Most people will immediately say the resurrection, which it is obviously a crowning miracle in the Bible. However, it's not the biggest miracle in the Bible or the greatest miracle in the Bible. The greatest miracle in the Bible is the first verse. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. If that verse is true, every other verse is believable.
Mm.
Now, we have good scientific and even philosophical evidence that the first verse is indeed true, that there was a beginning to space, matter, and time, or space, time, and matter, and it appears that God is the cause of that. If Genesis 1:1 is true, if God can create the whole universe out of nothing, can he do whatever he wants that's not logically impossible inside the universe?
Mm.
Of course, he can walk on water, he can raise Jesus from the dead, he can keep Jonah alive in a fish for 3 days, or kill him and resurrect him and spit him out on land. That's not a problem for a God who can create the whole universe out of nothing. It's easy. So if the first verse is true, every other verse is at least believable.
Okay, let's pause right there. We're going to do a one-minute station break, and we're going to come back and talk about this. Is the first verse really true? Let's talk a little about the Big Bang Theory. And what's behind that. We'll be right back.
Visit us online at thevitalconnection.org to comment on this program, to listen to other shows, and to see what is coming in the days ahead. Consider giving to help us reach others around the world. Again, our address is thevitalconnection.org.
Welcome back to The Vital Connection. Our guest today is Dr. Frank Turek, and he's written a book with Norman Geisler titled, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. And so we're talking about how one might go from having no faith in God to realizing to believe in the God of the Bible is the most logical thing I could ever do. And it's, in fact, more logical than being an atheist. And we're just beginning to get into, in cosmology, the beginnings of all things, which scientists now call the Big Bang. And Frank, you mentioned in your book how for Einstein, the theory of general relativity pointed toward everything having a beginning, not a constant state in the universe. And in other words, it pointed toward, one could argue, a theistic God. Can you unpack that a little bit?
Sure, that there's actually five lines of scientific evidence we lay out in the book for a beginning. And by the way, there's a difference between the Big Bang theory and the evidence for the Big Bang. The Big Bang theory is, well, this all came into existence, but we don't know how it came into existence. The evidence for the Big Bang is that there was a Big Bang. There was, and that was actually a pejorative term used by Sir Fred Hoyle, an atheist who didn't like the theory initially, and he said, what are you going to call this thing, the Big Bang? And the name actually stuck. It was supposed to be a term of derision. But in any event, the evidence shows that beyond any reasonable doubt, space, matter, and time had a beginning, including Einstein's theory of general relativity shows that space, time, and matter had a beginning. Mm-hmm. And so all we're saying here is that there was a beginning to space, time, and matter, which again, as you look at the evidence, how do you interpret the evidence? It seems to me if space, time, and matter had a beginning, the cause must transcend space, time, and matter. Mm. Must be spaceless, timeless, and immaterial. Now, Christians argue over how long ago this was and all that. Right. Regardless of how long ago it was, space, time, and matter had a beginning.
Yes. And so we have the laws of thermodynamics.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about it just briefly. How does that relate?
Well, the second law of thermodynamics says that the total amount of energy in the universe of usable energy is decreasing. The total amount of usable energy is decreasing. The total amount of energy stays the same, but the amount of usable energy goes down. So ultimately, we're going to run out of energy. In other words, one day, for example, that sun's going to burn up.
Mm-hmm.
You say, okay, well, how does that show the universe had a beginning? Because if it was eternal, that sun would have burned out a long time ago. If the universe was eternal, we'd be out of energy right now. If the second law of thermodynamics was in place from all eternity, we wouldn't have any energy left, but we still have energy right now. It's also called the law of entropy or disorder.
Mm-hmm.
We're going further and further toward disorder right now. Well, if the universe was eternal, we'd be at complete disorder right now, but we're not. We still have order to the universe, which shows that the universe had a beginning. You could put it this way, the second law of thermodynamics, you could state it this way. Nature will take a building and turn it into a pile of bricks. It goes from order to disorder.
Hmm.
But nature will never take a pile of bricks and turn it into a building.
And so Edwin Hubble looked through a telescope and found a big discovery that also points to the beginning of all things. What was that?
That was the fact that the universe was expanding, that all the galaxies are moving away from us. Well, if you go back in time, you would see all the galaxies collapse back to a point mathematically of nothing. They all came from a single point.
Right.
And when you add this to some other discoveries, you come up with what scientists call the Big Bang.
Yeah, it's incredible, isn't it, how scientists, more and more discoveries show that everything had a beginning, right down, as you say, to a point smaller than the point of a needle. I mean, from nothing, it all began. And as they continue to confirm it, they continue to try to come up with philosophical arguments for ways it might have happened otherwise. For example, well, Frank, let me put it this way. What do you say about the idea that there are a multiplicity of universes out there? If we just have enough universes, it might have all come into being by chance somehow.
Yeah, that's the multiverse,
mm-hmm.
which is put forth by scientists trying to avoid the fine-tuning of the universe, because the universe is highly fine-tuned. Anyone, if a number of factors were different, there would be no universe, much less life. And so their way of getting out of that is to say, well, maybe we're just one of an infinite number of universes, and we just happen to look designed, even though we're really not designed. There's a number of problems with that. First of all, there's no evidence that there are other universes out there. We can't detect them. I always hear atheists saying, well, we ought not believe in things we can't see, feel, touch, hear, or smell. Well, can you see, feel, touch, taste, or smell another universe? No. So why are you believing it then?
Yeah.
I mean, they're always claiming atheists are resorting to magic and all these pejorative terms, when in fact, that's what they're doing with the multiverse.
Yeah, and for each one of those, they're multiplying their problems, aren't they? Because for each new universe, you have to have a cause.
Yeah, you have to have some sort of creator for these multiverses. I mean, how do these things get started? Not only that, but three cosmologists back in 2003, Valenkin, Bord, and Guth, came up with the theorem in which they declared that any universe that is in a state of expansion had to have a beginning. And they go on to say that even if there is a multiverse out there, that there are many universes out there, all the universes together had to have a beginning. So even if it's true that there are other universes out there, and oh, by the way, this wouldn't in any way conflict with Christianity. Maybe there are other universes out there that would conflict necessarily with Christianity.
Right.
But if there are other universes out there, according to Bord, Guth, and Vilenkin, they all need a beginning. So you don't get rid of the need for an absolute beginner or beginning, even if a multiverse exists.
And then there's the idea of the bounce, the idea that, okay, there's a big bang, everything expands, and then it contracts again. And this has been happening repeatedly through time, but that doesn't really work either.
Now, the problem is it violates the second law of thermodynamics. We'd run out of energy to keep expanding, contracting, and banging again. Also, the evidence seems to point that right now the universe is actually accelerating, and there's therefore not enough energy, or not enough, I should say, matter in the universe to pull it all back. Recent satellites have found that the universe is going to expand into the indefinite future. It's not going to contract back on itself. So the multi-bang theory doesn't work either.
And I mean, they couldn't be infinite, because matter is finite. And so it couldn't continue to bang on forever. And so there are real problems with doing anything other than admitting it all began from nothing. And we come to that realization, and we have to say to ourselves, well, is there really a God? And then some say, well, maybe all this, and they get into a matter of life. How did life begin? And let's talk about, you mentioned how one-celled animal, an amoeba, has a DNA of 10,000, was it, encyclopedias?
10,000 encyclopias worth of DNA information in it. Yeah.
It's incredible when you think about it. But they'd say, but give us enough time and chance. Talk to me about that word chance.
Chance is not a cause. Chance is a word we use to describe mathematical possibilities, but chance doesn't cause anything. You know, if I flip a coin, what are the chances it's going to come up heads or tails? Well, if it's a fair coin, 50-50, right? But chance doesn't cause it. Chance is a word we just use to cover our ignorance.
Yes.
What causes the coin to come up heads or tails? Well, how much force you put on it, how far above the floor you are, what are the winds in the room, or, you know, whatever. Physical forces and the agent that flips it cause the coin to come up heads or tails. And if we knew all those forces with exact precision, we could predict every time which way it's going to come up. But chance doesn't do any of that. Chance is just a word that covers our ignorance.
And I love the illustration in your book. It was fresh to me when it was said, if you had an airplane flying at maybe 1,000 feet and they dropped graffiti and all these colors came out and spelled out a sentence on the ground by chance and time, but it wasn't quite right. So we're going to give a little more chance and time. The analogy would be then to move up to 10,000 feet.
Yeah, confetti. Yeah, drop confetti from 1,000 feet. What are the chances it's going to spell the American flag on your lawn? Or
there
spell
you
your name on your lawn? Well, not very good. Well, you say, give it more time. Well, let's take it up to 10,000 feet and drop the confetti from there. Is that going to increase the chances it's going to put the American flag on your lawn or spell your name on your lawn? No, it's going to decrease it. So more time doesn't help the idea that you're going to get what we call specified complexity or information. More time actually reduces the chance of that, because nature tends to disorder things, not order things. Again, nature will take a building and turn it into a pile of bricks. It won't take a pile of bricks and turn it into a building.
And so a man like Richard Dawkins writes to say, but actually there's this universal force. There's something in the universe through time and space. It's not just chance, it's evolution that improves on itself, like a non-divine mind, you know? And other authors, they pause and blink and say, wait a minute, you're introducing something into your theory of evolution that is like a divine God, you know? You're just not giving it the name.
Right, yeah, you're putting a mind into evolution. First of all, evolution is a biological process that can't explain where biology came from to begin with. I mean, In order for evolution or natural selection to work, you need a living thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, where did the living thing come from? And then where did the constituents that make the living thing come from? In other words, before you ever start talking about biology, you got to talk. You got to have a universe, and you got to have life.
Right.
And the atheist is always quick to say, well, you know, our theory doesn't deal with those things. Well, if your theory doesn't deal with those things, or your worldview doesn't deal with those things, then you have an inadequate worldview.
Yeah.
You have to have a explanation for the universe and life in order to say that atheism is true. Because if you don't have an atheistic explanation for those things, those are some pretty big holes. In fact, you could drive a whole universe through that hole. Right?
Yeah.
If you don't have an explanation for the universe, you say, oh, it's just
well
a God of the gaps argument to put God in as the cause. No, it's not a God of the gaps argument. We don't just lack a natural explanation for the first life or for the universe. We have positive evidence for an intelligent, spaceless, timeless, immaterial, powerful, moral, personal, intelligent creator.
Yeah.
In other words, it's not on what we don't know that has us say, well, God did it. It's on what we do know.
Right, right. And it's amazing how the naturalistic person, perhaps a scientist, will say, but you're jumping, it's not what you know, you're jumping on assumptions. You're just looking at hints and clues and like creative design. This whole idea that there's a God, there's no evidence, but isn't that how science works? We intuit things.
Yes, and again, science doesn't say anything scientists do. And there are elements of science that can't be proven scientifically. In other words, science is built on philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do science without philosophy. For example, you can't do science without the laws of logic. You can't prove them by science. You have to assume them in order to do science. You can't prove the law of causality by science. You have to assume that everything that comes to be has a cause in order to do science. You can't run an experiment to figure that out. You have to assume that in order to do the experiment.
Right. Right.
So there are several things that science can't even get off the ground with unless these things actually exist. Your mind. You have to use your mind to interpret the data. You have to assume that your mind can appropriate attributes of the objective world and take the data from the objective world and interpret the data properly in order to come to a scientific conclusion. And that is something you have to presuppose in order to do science. It's not something that science you can learn by doing an experiment. In order to do an experiment, you have to be able to do that. Of course, science can't deal with morality either. Where does morality come from? You can't put honesty in a test tube. That's something you have to impose on the experiment before you get there.
You all make the really good point that the naturalist will say, I can demonstrate things by what I experience. David Hume, for example. But anything other than that is not real. But who wants to buy into a world with no moral standards?
Well, we know there are moral standards, and the moral standards can't originate with us. If so, they're relative, and you can't say, therefore, say the Nazis were wrong. It's just your opinion.
Right.
If there's no standard beyond humanity, then we're just talking about human opinions. We're just talking about, you know, Mother Teresa versus Hitler. In fact, there's a chapter in our book, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. That's what it's called, Mother Teresa versus Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's no standard beyond humanity, then there's no moral difference between Mother Teresa and Hitler. It's just a matter of opinion. Now, we all intuitively understand that, say, torturing babies for fun is really wrong. That murdering 6 million Jews is really wrong. It's not just a matter of opinion. It's just the way things are. Well, there must be a moral law giver if there is a moral law. Every prescription has a prescriber. If there's a moral law prescription that transcends cultures and transcends humanity, there must be a moral law prescriber that transcends cultures and transcends humanity, something that's objective and unchangeable. That's what we mean by God.
Yeah, I'm going to bring you back just for a minute, back to the idea of there being a God. And I just want to go back to your Apollo 13 illustration. I thought it was great. It is, in your book, you're unpacking the evidences for there being a creator. Talk to us about that, the anthropic principle.
Well, the anthropic principle is sometimes called the fine-tuning of the universe, that the universe is highly fine-tuned to support life. In fact, the universe is highly fine-tuned even to have chemistry, for that matter, not just an argument for life, but the fact that there's anything other in anything else in the universe other than, say, hydrogen and helium. You know, the universe is highly fine-tuned. Stephen Hawking said, you know, if the expansion rate of the universe was different by one part in a thousand million million a second after the Big Bang, we wouldn't be here.
Mm-hmm.
A thousand million million. Now, Hawking's an atheist, but he's saying, look, the universe is so highly fine-tuned. If the gravitational force was different by one part in 10 to the 40, we wouldn't be here. Now, that's one part in one with 40 zeros following it, to give you an illustration of the kind of precision we're talking about. If you took a tape measure and stretched it across the entire known universe, that's a long way, by the way, and
yeah.
you were to set gravity at a particular inch mark on that tape measure, now I know gravity is not measured in inches, this is just to give you a scale idea in your mind.
Mm.
If you were to move the strength of gravity one inch in either direction across the entire known universe, across that incredibly long scale, we wouldn't be here. That's how highly fine-tuned the gravitational force is. That's 1 in 10 to the 40 precision.
Wow.
Move the gravitational force 1 inch on a scale across the entire known universe and we wouldn't exist.
Thinking about the universe, you'll unpack this. Just look at our small little galaxy, such a pinpoint compared to the whole universe, with 100 billion stars each 30 trillion miles apart.
Mm-hmm.
That if, say, a space shuttle is moving at 17,000 miles an hour, 5 miles a second, it would take more than 200,000 years just to go that 30 trillion miles. And so we can't fathom it.
Right, yeah. We're not going anywhere in space. You know, space programming.
Yeah.
You can hardly get out of our solar system. I mean, it would take us, as you just said, over 200,000 years, if we could go at space shuttle speed. When it's in orbit, it's going 5 miles a second. But at 5 miles a second, it would take you over 200,000 years to go 30 trillion miles, which is the average distance between stars in our galaxy. So go to the next nearest star other than the sun.
Mm.
It's going to take you about 200,000 years at 5 miles a second.
And now you've got a tape measure going way beyond our galaxy.
Yes.
Spanning the universe.
Mm-hmm.
That's
why the heavens declare the glory of God. That's why Paul says in Romans chapter 1 that people are without excuse. We're without excuse. We know there's a God because his invisible qualities and divine attributes are clearly seen. You just look up at the sky and you go, somebody must have made this.
Mm.
And you can look inside of you and see the same thing.
Yes.
Whether you look through a microscope or a telescope, you're going to see awesome design.
And so people look at these arguments that go back in part to Paley, the idea of a first cause, the idea of a designer, and people like Dawkins say, well, that we've all given up on that. We know that stuff doesn't hold true. And yet your book brings us right back to it, and it demonstrates how it is the most logical argument for how things came into being.
Yes, and the other argument that we make a little bit in there is the argument from reason itself.
Hmm.
An atheist has no grounds to even believe his own reason. I mean, if we're just molecules in motion, why believe atheism's true? So I got evidence there is no God. You do? Oh, yeah, here's the evidence. Oh, how do you even know it's true? How do you even know what you're thinking is reliable? If you're just a molecular machine, if there's no immaterial reality, which is what most atheists believe, that, you know, we're just molecules in motion, all that exists are the elements on the periodic table, then why should you believe your mind?
Yeah.
Why should you believe what you come to conclude? In fact, even Darwin, it's called Darwin's Doubt. Darwin had a great doubt about his own theory. He said, why should I even believe my conclusions? Why should I believe, if my mind is the product of a monkey's mind, why should I believe it? So the very fact that there are immaterial, immovable laws of logic that we can access right now. In fact, if you're listening to this radio program right now, you're using them to even understand what we're saying. These things are not made of material. They're immaterial laws.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if that's the case, materialism's false, which means atheism's false.
Mm-hmm. Materialism, of course, for the listener, being the worldview that the perspective that says anything that's true can be shown to be a material object, material
well,
substance.
Well, non-contradiction is not a material object.
Yeah, I mean, scientific theorems are not material objects.
The thoughts that you have in your mind. Like if I say right now, two-ton elephant, or if I say two-ton pink elephant, everyone's thinking of a two-ton pink elephant right now, but there's literally not a two-ton pink elephant in your head. You know, you'd be dead. You could kill people by just saying, two-ton pink elephant, bang. Oh, no.
You know, when we hear people say, I'm a Christian, but I'm also an atheist, they say, no, that doesn't work because it means you're not a Christian. Now, we understand that. If someone says, I'm a scientist and I believe science disproves God, I'm an atheist, we don't understand how wrong that is. There are people that say they're scientists and they claim they're sure there is no God.
Well, when somebody says that, it's not your job to refute it, it's their job to support it. So you're going to ask a couple questions. The first question is, what do you mean by that? Mm. What do you mean by science disproves God? Explain that to me. Second question is, how did you come to that conclusion? And see if they can explain it, because they can't. They can't explain it. How could a process to discover causes, by their definition, causes in the natural world, show that there's no cause outside the natural world?
Mm-hmm.
How could they do that? They're trying to say, on one hand, science disproves God, and they define science as causal connections inside the natural world. Then if that's their definition of science, how could science show that there's no cause outside the natural world?
Yeah, it's astounding. Frank, we've got just a few minutes left. Let's talk to the listeners about how they can tap more into your resources. What's your website?
The website's crossexamined.org. That's crossexamined with a D on the end of it, .org. And there's plenty of resources up there. We also have a sister website that carries all of our products. We have over 100 TV shows out there. It's linked at crossexamined.org, but if you want to go there directly, it's impactapologetics.com. That's impactapologetics.com. Mm-hmm. And we're on TV every Wednesday night at 9 p.m. and 1 a.m. Eastern Time if you're an insomniac. We're also on it Saturdays at 10 p.m.
Okay.
And all the details are on our website. That's DirecTV Channel 378. We're also on Sky Angel Channel 126.
And if they want to get a hold of your book, I don't have enough faith.
They get it at impactapologetics.com. It's on Amazon. If you go to a bookstore and it's not there, I just say, look, sold out again.
Yeah.
But no, you can get it at impactapologetics.com. We also have a DVD set which goes through all the material in kind of a fun way. So that's available. It's called Why I Still Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist.
Excellent. And we've gotten into mostly the first part of the book. We've hardly gotten deeply into it. And if you're willing, maybe we'll bring you back on later to get into the latter part of the book. But I just want to say thank you for your ministry. It especially touches me that you're taking the time to go to the students of the world whose minds are being shaped by a worldview that frankly has shifted from the Christian foundation into a naturalistic foundation. And you're in the middle of a very significant battle, Frank. I want to thank you for taking the time and effort to be out there.
Well, thanks for having me on, Bill. And again, people can get more at crossexamine.org. We have a whole team of people doing this. And every August, we have a cross-examine instructor academy here in Charlotte where we teach people who have a background in apologetics how to go out and do this. So people can check that out on our website as well.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, God bless you. And I'm going to close in this prayer. Lord, we pray that you'd help us all to be ones who use the minds you've given us, not to be lazy, but to be diligent about pursuing truth and seeing, Lord, that there are two sides to every story, but in the end, we'll meet a person, if we truly search, who has created all things and gives us new life, and his name is Jesus Christ. So we thank you for this time now, and we commit this day to you. Amen.
Thank you for joining us for today's program. To be part of our online community, visit us at thevitalconnection.org. If you have comments or would like to make a contribution, our mailing address is Post Office Box 6007, Hendersonville, North Carolina, 28793. You have been listening to The Vital Connection.